The topic is open objectivism, and let me just say a note of background. This was a term, concept, a view that I developed over 30 years ago, and this approach to objectivism as a philosophy is something that's been part of our policy as an organization ever since. I think it's fair to say it's something like the DNA of our organization. It's so deep. I want to say a few words by introduction, but try to leave as much questions as possible, because I know many people on the call are familiar with this this idea and the distinction between open objectivism, our view, and the view of objectivism as a closed philosophy. So first of all, I want to make an important point that is not always well understood. The idea of open objectivism is not about the content of the philosophy. The philosophy is objectivism, period. What open objectivism means, it has to do with the nature of the philosophy as a body of knowledge. And essentially, as I've explained and others have pointed out many times, it's that the philosophy is a body of knowledge, and like any body of knowledge, is open to expansion, revision if necessary, exploration and further discovery. This is by contrast with the closed view. So, you know, an important principle of conceptual understanding is to understand a concept, you have to understand its opposite. So let me just say a few words about what the closed philosophy is. This was a view originally put forward by Leonard Peikoff in an article that was critical of a short piece I wrote in 1989. The closed view of objectivism is that, this is a view about philosophy in general, a philosophical system like objectivism, by nature, is a totality of a body of logically integrated principles that cover every issue in philosophy. That's the idea of a system of philosophy rather than a single individual philosophical thesis. Leonard Peikoff, in that article I mentioned, said, and this is a quote, "The essence of the system, its fundamental principles and their consequences in every branch of philosophy, is laid down once and for all by the author, by the philosopher's author," which for objectivism is obviously Ayn Rand. So as I understand this, it involves two claims. First of all, because it covers all issues, objectivism is complete. There are no gaps in the philosophy, no issue left unaddressed or without a philosophical view on that issue. It's complete. And the second one is that because it's integrated, no element can be changed without altering the entire system. Any change would ripple through the system and change the meaning of everything else, or the confirmation of it, or the whatever, which means it has a fixed identity. It is fixed. And the common view that Leonard defended in that at that time was the fixed identity includes all and everything that Ayn Rand wrote on philosophy, wrote or approved in philosophy. She said a lot of stuff about political events. She expressed a lot of her views about specific works of art. These are not necessarily part of the totality of objectivism. They're applications, but everything in all of her philosophical views down to ethics, politics, details in ethics, politics, aesthetics, as well as metaphysics and epistemology. This is all, objectivism is all but only that. So in that respect, he's saying that philosophy is not like science. And the rationale, I think, as I analyzed it, trying to understand his essay, is that the philosophy, unlike science, is based on observations that are available to people in any age. So it's not subject to further scientific discoveries or any other kind of discovery over time. So that's the closed view. The open view is that, first of all, it's not complete. I don't think that objectivism, as Rand left it, does cover every single issue. Objectivist philosophers are pretty much across the board are constantly working on new issues, new aspects of existing issues. On our side of the fence, there are some editions that I think have stood the test of time. I wrote a book on benevolence, and I believe making the argument that benevolence is the key. objectivist virtue was not part of Rand's official ethics, although I think it's very consistent with most of what she wrote. She herself, in epistemology, she herself said that the problem of induction was not one that she had solved or provided a detailed theory on or adequate philosophical theory on. And 12 years ago in 2010, Leonard Peikoff and David Harriman published a book called The Logical Leap, which was trying to fill that gap. So they themselves were adding to the philosophy. Among other issues I could mention, Rand had very little to say about families and the ethics of families, which are hugely important in a lot of people's lives. And I could go on, but those are some examples of areas that were not covered and that can be covered. So that's a response to the idea that objectivism is fixed and complete. If it's not fixed, then how do we identify, how do we define objectivism? The case I made, objectivism does have an identity. It's different from other philosophical systems and viewpoints. But how? Well, I made the case that any philosophy, including objectivism, has to be identified by core principles, the essential principles that make up the skeleton of the whole system of ideas that everything else hangs on and relates to. But those core principles leave open a lot of room for discussion, analysis, and expansion too. So in the book that I wrote in response to Peikoff's article, called Truth and Toleration, which is now in our, I guess, a third edition now that we've recently published within the last few years. In that chapter 5, for those of you who are familiar with it, I took on the task of trying to define what those core principles are. I consider that's a very scholarly task. I mean, you have to think hard about what it is that's really distinctive about objectivism, what's essential to it, and what essentially differentiates it from other philosophies, whether Platonism or Kantianism, existentialism, or whatever. I should add here that I considered that, even at the time I was writing it, I considered this task part of an open approach, and I was subject to revision as needed. To my knowledge, almost no one, I don't really know of any substantial critique of my analysis. But actually, I'd love to see it, because I can well have left stuff out. One reason that I'm taking this, because this is such an old issue and so much has been written, the reason I thought it might be a good idea to revisit it for this clubhouse, really twofold. One is, we have a lot of younger people, newer people who don't have that 30-year background that some of us have, and are just getting introduced to the objective, to the philosophy of objectivism, which is great. So this is important, and it's important for understanding how the Atlas Society functions. Recently, in the last year and a half, we've added a number of scholars who are senior scholars, senior fellows, who have their own background in objectivism, we often discuss and debate the issues. So I think we're all on board about the idea of open objectivism, but we also illustrate what one of the features of open objectivism, which is that there can be debates over many issues among rational people. And finally, another reason is that last spring, the Ayn Rand Institute, which had been the exponent of the closed view, came out with a long article in which it seemed to seed a number of points to that we've been arguing for many, many years. We have an article on our website called "A New Era in Objectivism," which I recommend if you haven't seen it already. So that's a brief introduction to the issue. I just want to make one more point. The origin of this dispute 30 plus years ago did not begin with the open versus closed issue. It began with my defense of intellectual tolerance, which arose out of I was attacked by someone who said I should not have been speaking to a libertarian group as I did. And my argument was, well, wait a minute. Intellectual toleration has a value in that debating with people who don't necessarily agree with us can teach us something. We can learn from it. Sometimes they, as I often like to say, critics can be useful predators, at least in picking off your weak arguments and getting rid of them. Even if you end up without changing your mind, you typically end up with a better, deeper understanding of your position. In that context, I said objectivism is of course open. I always took that as obvious. I had no idea anyone would disagree with that. But objectivism tolerance rather, was a way of expanding our knowledge. It was a means to the end of greater knowledge, deeper knowledge. And what I came to understand is that if the philosophy is closed and fixed, then we don't really have anything to learn, do we? So why be tolerant? And I felt like that was an insight into something about the movement that had been disturbing me. So anyhow, I still think that the goal of objectivist thinkers is expansion, revision as needed, and further development, whether it comes from discussion with others or from internal reflection. But I also want to say that the idea of toleration here has a practical or social aspect as well as an intellectual one. it's a way of dealing with people, and I think it's a form of benevolence. And that difference, that aspect is something that is a remaining difference, kind of, I think, in the two camps in objectivism. Openness to discussion and debate is treating other people as intellectual, potentially intellectual partners in the discovery of truth, rather than enemies that we have to refute and shut down completely. And underlying, you know, over the years I've come to think that one difference among different schools or areas of objectivist thought is how you believe we fit with the world. Are objectivists an isolated community against a hostile world, a culturally hostile, politically hostile world? Or are we part of a world, participants in a marketplace of ideas where we could disagree vehemently in some cases and disagree on some, in some cases, because there are ideas out there that are vicious and destructive if acted on, but many are not at that extreme. So I felt that the sense of alienation and isolation in the world is something that has been a problem in objectivism. Tolerance is not the only piece of it. It's really the answer has more to do with benevolence in general. But I'll just end by saying I happen to notice, in for those of you who are have the TAS 2022 calendar, 2 days ago on Tuesday, there was a nice one from Eric, nice calendar quote, a meme, this one from Eric Hoffer, that said, mass movements can rise and spread without a belief in God, but never without a belief in a devil. And boy, did that ever hit me when I was thinking about objectivism. I don't know if that was the point of choosing this. Jag, maybe you can speak to that. But anyway, so that's a brief introduction just on a couple of points. But I'd like to turn it over to discussion now. And you know, at this point, I think the kinds of questions people have and further exploration is more important than anything I can say. So let me leave it there.
Thank you, David. I also want to encourage all of you who are in this room, please share the room on Clubhouse. You can also share it on Twitter or Facebook. Just use the share button down next to the comment button. I'm seeing some questions being raised in the comments. Please raise your hand. We'll bring you on up and hope to have a productive conversation with David. So, Craig, you were the first to raise your hand. Do you have a question for David? Just need to unmute yourself. And as you're figuring that up, we'll go to James.
Thank you. David, in your book, you mentioned that your own Brooke has said that Ayn Rand wanted to have the name objectivism limited only to those things that she wrote, and anything beyond that would have to, it couldn't be called objectivism, sort of like Harry Binswanger's book. He says it's on an objectivist basis, but he doesn't call it objectivism. Is that really the issue here? It's just a question of what's going to be included in the name objectivism and limiting it to what Ayn Rand wrote?
Excuse me. That is one of the arguments that people have offered for the closed view. And with all due respect to Rand, I don't think she can demand that she owns or has anything comparable to a copyright in the term objectivism. Actually, she doesn't. She can't. I won't go into all the details, but I know for a fact that it can't. That term cannot be copyrighted because it's in common use. But it's odd for her philosophy to for philosopher to provide a name to create a philosophy and put it out in the world as a body of knowledge about reality. It's not an art of, it's not a work of fiction, objectivism. She has every right to copyright Atlas Shrugged, and you know she owns that and owned it anyway. And no one can add or subtract, add anything to the Atlas Shrugged or subtract anything from it and still claim that it's Atlas Shrugged. But objectivism is a philosophy, and it's like, you know, evolutionary biology or you call it Darwinism. But even when you attach the name of Darwin to the theory of evolution, it was a theory in biology that was offered to the world. It was taken up and explored, expanded, and developed much, much more fully. And there's no, Ayn Rand herself said, you cannot copyright ideas. You can't copyright truths of reality. So I would say this argument doesn't wash. And I don't think it's a primary. The most I think that maybe Yaron Brooke or others would say is out of a courtesy to Rand, we should keep the term limited that way. But, you know, while she was alive, I probably would have respected that courtesy out of honor to her. But, you know, it's been a long time now. So philosophy is going to live and not live. It needs a name. And if it, what better name than the one that she gave it and that we've all been using for decades now.
All right, Craig, I see you're unmuted. So.
Thank you, yes. Many years ago, I was on the staff at MIT for 5 years, and every year I would go to the Ford Hall Forum to listen to Ayn Rand. And one year I raised my hand and asked a question that I think shed some light, her answer shed some light on this whole issue. I asked, my background is mathematics. I have a BS in math from Stanford. I was on the math team for 5 years. So I knew about the foundations of mathematics, the early arguments about it, the Russell paradox, Gödel's incompleteness theorems, and so on. And I've written a monograph about it. Anyway, the question I asked her was, Ms. Rand, have you or any of your associates, and I was thinking here of Alan Gotthelf, done any work on applying objectivist epistemology to the foundations of mathematics? Which I thought was a useful question. She leaned forward with a half smile on her face, looked directly at me and said, well, you know, I can't do everything. And what this says is she knew that objectivism was not complete. She knew there would be additional work one. She seconded this in her introduction to objectivist epistemology, where she made it clear it's only an introduction. As David Kelly has pointed out, objectivism, in his opinion, doesn't have a theory of propositions. You know, we could discuss mm-hmm. that some other time. But I wanted to add that historical incident. She knew it wasn't complete. That's the point.
Yeah, I think, thank you, Craig. That I hadn't heard that story before, but it certainly, there are other comments that she made that indicated, at least in some moods or some contexts, she recognized that there was more to do. And in fact, one of our scholars, not on our staff, but David Ross, applied mathematician, has done some work that we want to get published on the foundations of mathematics, precisely. But So I just, in the course of thinking about all this and developing my own ideas, I went through every source I could find and at one time and made a list of where Rand herself seemed to be open to an open view, expansionary view of her philosophy, and where she did not. Unfortunately, I didn't know the year story, so I'll add that. But I should say also that I would be glad to have Rand's backing for this, because I've learned so much across so many domains from her. But at the end of the day, it's not a question of what she says or what she wanted. It's not an issue of authority. It's really an issue of what the nature of a philosophy is. And that's an issue about reality and right. cognition.
So, may I make two more quick points?
Sure.
The first one is, I wrote a monograph about objectivist epistemology applied to the foundations of mathematics, and I call it The Foundations of Mathematics on an Objectivist Basis. I think that's the right way to pay proper respect, and it avoids completely the question of open versus closed. Okay.
Uh-huh. Well,
the second point is, there's a wonderful poem by Rudyard Kipling called The Disciple, which every time I read it, I think of Leonard Peikoff. It talks about the disciple will say, well, the master would have thought this or would have said this, and so on. And I encourage you to read the poem and think of Leonard.
All right. I've read a lot of Kipling, but I don't think I've read that one. Thank you.
Great. I would love to get some more questions in from the audience. So please raise your hand if you have a question or a comment, and we will bring you on up. John Lang. Hey, John. John, if you want to unmute yourself. There you go. Go ahead and unmute.
There I am.
There you are.
Thank you. I'm sorry. David, is there in any sense that philosophy can be isolated away from humanity? That is, that it can be a fixed set of knowledge that stands independent of its human origins? Kind of a metaphysiological question.
Yeah, John, I'm not exactly sure I understand.
I ask the question because if you're going to have a closed system, then you're isolating it from the dynamic aspect of humanity. You're removing it from one of my interests, which is evolutionary psychology or sociobiology. And if you're going to have a closed system, then you're isolating it away from the change of humanity that appears to me as a continuous contribution and a change agent in philosophy. So any philosophy that you attempt to close is bound to wind up somehow in error because of a clash with the change in its environment, i.e. humanity.
Well, I would, thank you, John. I would want to distinguish philosophy is a product of human beings and of their cognitive capacities and of the ability to abstract. So you can close off cognition. In fact, everything in the entire objectivist epistemology says that's a disaster. Context keeps expanding. Discoveries are always possible across any domain of knowledge. But of course, that's a point about cognition. we keep discovering new things, and some of them will be relevant to at the level, at philosophical level, possibly to one or another tenet of objectivism. Whether the a philosophy has to change with broader changes in the world, well, yes. Ayn Rand herself made a point about the concept of the the role of man's mind in production, that before the Industrial Revolution, that could not have been as clear as it is today, and that many of the aspects of that, including individual rights and property rights and so forth, although that, you know, people had some glimpse of that, it was only the Industrial Revolution and the, you know, astounding productivity that was unleashed under capitalism, that people could fully appreciate the role of the mind in man's life. Okay, well, so now the Industrial Revolution and the birth of capitalism happened because people were thinking things. That is, they were fundamentally based on cognitive insights. But once the changes happened in the world, then they became data for a whole new way of life. And that new way of life, like you say, you know, it calls for philosophical acknowledgement, adjustment, maybe. So I think I'm partly agreeing with you anyway. Does that make sense?
Yes. I mean, maybe to refine it, I just see Rand as a mid-20th century empiricist who did not have the benefit of reading Edmund O. Wilson or the subsequent thought in evolutionary psychology. And I think that those would have been critical things that would have changed her thinking on some subjects if they had been available to her. So objectivism would be a different body of philosophy if Rand had been exposed to Edmund O. Wilson.
Yeah, well, without, you know, commenting on Wilson himself or any of the other evolutionary thinkers, there certainly is an issue, and it's a psychological and cognitive science issue, about the extent to which humans have inborn capacities that are the product of evolution. I mean, there's no question that the mind in general evolves, but the specific claims sometimes made on the part of that question, the blank slate view. Rand herself, I don't know how much she knew about that. She tended to claim that we have the capacity for reason, we have the capacity for emotion, but the content of our thoughts and feelings are all derived from perception. I think that needs closer study and modification. Although I would, in the end of the day, say, you know, all knowledge comes from perceiving reality in one form or another, and that we have free will. Nothing is going to change that, because that would contradict
another aspect. Another thing I'd want to add to the mix here is that the history of humanity and of human knowledge is one of improvement in the tools of perception. For example, the microscope and the telescope, and then from there, the electron microscope, and so on. And then mathematics itself as a tool of exploration of reality. Those were things that, ideas that were not available to Rand in propounding, developing objectivism and its epistemology. And since philosophies relate to human nature and how people behave and conduct themselves, that I think that's got to come into the mix too, is how knowledge is acquired, how concepts are formed.
That's a great point, John. We've got Richard, another senior scholar here at the Atlas Society, Professor Richard Salzman, Professor of Political Economy at Duke. So, Clark, if you'll hold on for a second, I'm going to go to Professor Salzman next.
Thank you, Jennifer. Thank you for this, David. I want to get back to the topic of the day. A couple of points that might be helpful. Rand, in her Mike Wallace interview in 1958 on TV, a couple of times in that interview, he referred to the Randian philosophy, and she really objected to that and said to him, I don't want to call it that. Now think of this. She's thinking, I don't want it to be sui generis, I suppose it would be called in philosophy, or the suggestion of subjectivism. So the same thing like with Marxism, Keynesianism. And the idea that in, I think it was formally, I'm looking at the intro, the preface to The New Intellectual, just 3 years later, she says, for this reason, I call my philosophy objectivism. So that seemed to be the first public statement of her saying, this is the name. And Leonard has private stories about how they came to that name. But I just wanted to mention that because if the closed system truly is, I'm not sure this is accurate, but suppose it was anything she ever said or wrote, then that would be more accurately called Randianism. It would not objectivism. Yeah. And this is what she was resisting. So I've always found it odd that the closed system, claiming to be the keeper of the flame, so to speak, of objectivism, really tried to turn it into Randianism, which she publicly rejected. So that's the first thing. But the other thing is, listen to these passages in the preface. She says, now this is the preface to The New Intellectual, which was a bunch of excerpts of the speeches from the fiction. Now it had an introductory essay as well. But she describes this as follows. She says, this contains the main philosophic passages from my novels and presents the outline of a new philosophic system. I think the word outline is interesting. Then she says, the full system is implicit in these excerpts, but its fundamentals are indicated in the details of the books. That's very odd. She says, when I say that and she says something about, I will present this more fully in a future treatise. Okay, that didn't happen. Then at the end of the preface, when I say that these excerpts are merely an outline, I don't mean to imply that my full system is still to be defined or discovered. Until I complete the presentation of my philosophy in a fully detailed form, this present book may serve as an outline or a program or a manifesto. So I think that's interesting. Now, if we fast forward to 1976, this is 15 years later, Peikoff gives the Philosophy of Objectivism course in New York City, 12 lectures, I think it was. And at the time, in the Ayn Rand letter, Miss Rand wrote, quote, until, she's recommending the course, until or unless I write a comprehensive treatise on my philosophy, Dr. Peikoff's course is the only authorized presentation of the entire theoretical structure of objectivism, the only one I know of to my knowledge to be fully accurate, unquote. Now, fast forward to 1991. Now, she's died in 1982. In the preface to Peikoff's Opar, the Objectivism and Philosophy of Ayn Rand, he not only quotes that statement, but if you go to the internet and listen to the 76 course, it's prefaced by Leonard saying, I override the 76 course because of its logical defects and other things. And my book is to be seen as superseding what I did in 76. Right. I'm not saying this to criticize Opar. I think Opar has been a wonderful achievement, but it doesn't quite fit the closed objectivism approach. I mean, the book itself is the first full comprehensive presentation of her philosophy, which she had promised. But even he says at the end of the preface, even though I'm the person next to Ayn Rand who's most qualified to write this book, she's not responsible for any misstatements in it. And it can't be properly described as official objectivist doctrine. Objectivism is the name of Ayn Rand's philosophy as presented in the material she herself wrote or endorsed. So at the beginning of this wonderful book on objectivism, Leonard, who's quite an expert on it, is basically saying it's not objectivism or it's not official objectivism. And then defines objectivism in quotes is the name of the philosophy as presented in the material she herself wrote or endorsed. I suppose that would include the controversy about what about unpublished work. So after she died, Leonard and others brought out a bunch of unpublished work. Now, would she, is that considered part of Ayn Rand's philosophy? Because she didn't publish it. So there's all sorts of problems there. But I want to leave it. I do want to leave it with a question, David. When this came out, when the book came out and this preface came out, this was only 2 years after you and he disagreed about this. Does that presentation of it, that characterization of it, did it surprise you at the time? Did it make you think, well, he's basically come around to my view, that it's every man for himself and the best argument wins, and he's admitting that, and why aren't we all open objectivists?
Actually, thanks, Richard. I looked at all that stuff at the time I was writing it, and I've looked at it since. I can't make a single consistent claim out of it.
Okay.
But because there's so many different emphases, different contexts for different statements. Like, you know, as I said, I've got three or four page document of everything I could find that indicated one way or the other what Rand thought, and Peikoff and others too. But when Opar came out, I was not at all surprised, actually, because after my conflict and after I raised the issue of open versus whether objectivism is open or closed, I don't think anyone had discussed before. Many people, Leonard and others that arrived, became very, very careful. This is my take. This is not objectivism. Don't take it as objectivism in any official or authorized sense. And that's true of Harry Binswanger's How We Know book. It says the same thing. And many others have, many other works have had similar provisos in them. And I just kind of, I sort of maybe feel I have some responsibility for that, for those provisos, defensive as they, you know, the self-defense against, don't take me as an open objectivist. You know, I'm.
Yeah.
Objectivism is what Rand said, and I'm trying to describe only the piece of the elephant that I can see and feel. So, but I have to say, the whole idea of an authorized or official doctrine is so inimical to the idea of philosophy, to the idea of rationality in particular, and independence, and to the primacy of existence. I mean, a philosophy, the key question is whether a philosophy is true or false, whether it identifies facts of reality.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's an ongoing project. Rand did an astounding genius level of discovery.
Yeah.
But if she wanted it to be a living philosophy, if we want it to be a living philosophy, not a dead philosophy, not a dead language like Latin, for which the literature in Latin is closed. People still use Latin, but the Latin literature is a closed system, closed philosophy. And if that happened with objectivism, I would just feel, I would give up. If I thought that was the case for the objectivism, I'd just give it up.
I think of the analogy of a dead language. Why do languages become dead? They're out of use, not applicable anymore. If it was strictly closed objectivism, I suppose you could have an Ayn Rand Institute and a phone number, and any time the media or anyone else called, they would just say, read her books. I mean, any interpretation, any additional books, and his campus lecture would all be interpretive, and they wouldn't be her, they would be someone interpreting her. I'll leave one more thing I'll leave you with. I think it's very interesting that in the Ayn Rand lexicon, which Harry put out in 1986, 4 years after she died. And she knew about the project. He says in the preface, he brought this to her and said, I'm going to go through all your stuff and excerpt things and create amounts to a dictionary. And she said, that's impossible. Then he convinced her of a couple of passages. Anyway, what's interesting is on page 345, I'm looking at a passage called Objectivity. Now, I picked this one because this is no small thing. It's the essence of the philosophy, objectivity. It has one page of excerpts from various things. And what's interesting about this is if you go to OPAR, there are 40 pages and an entire chapter called Objectivity. Now, I think it's a fantastic chapter. My point, though, is how do you get 40 pages out of one? It's important that he did it. I'm glad there was a separate chapter on objectivity. But that alone tells us that here's a philosophy called objectivism. And in her own works, Harry could only come up with a page on objectivity. And Leonard, thankfully, gave us 40 pages. Tara Smith, in her recent book on legal theory, has a whole opening chapter on the meaning of objectivity before she talks about judicial review. And so good stuff was added, and I think mostly valid stuff was added to this very important concept. Isn't that yet another example of what needs to be done? And without adult, it's not adulteration, it's addition and amplification. It's really important stuff, but she didn't do it.
Right.
Thoughts, maybe being too hard.
One of the puzzles about this conflict to me is that in philosophy, there's a broad distinction between people or historians who are writing about the history of philosophy, Aristotle, Plato, whatever, and they are trying to interpret what the philosopher said.
Mm-hmm.
And often these arguments get very complex because, the scholars uncover ambiguities or different possible ways of interpreting a given statement. And that's exactly what a lot of objectivist scholars are doing with Rand. Mm-hmm. That's what mm-hmm. all these books, mm-hmm. articles on Rand's philosophy are.
Yep.
And the other approach to philosophy is what I call the problem-oriented one. Here's a philosophical problem. What's the best theory about it? What's the best solution? I'm going to solve this problem. I want to put out a theory that explains the answer to the questions. And these are two broad tendencies and functions. But I'm sorry, I had another call coming in. I had to. Am I still on?
Yeah, you're a little faint though.
Just make sure you're close to the phone, David. David?
Hello?
Yep, okay, you're back.
Okay. All right. What I was saying is that a number of the things that that Richard was pointing out, the 40 pages that Peikoff wrote on objectivity, and many more pages that others have written, are partly interpretation, but inevitably there's some expansion here. There's fleshing out of details.
Yep.
And so this is why I don't think the closed philosophy has never even been coherent to me as a position, because unless you just take Rand's words literally, I mean the actual words on paper as the only and final meaning of objectivism, then in which case there's nothing to do but read. No teaching, no explanation, no nothing.
Yep.
Which is, I don't think anyone believes. So anyway,
We've got about 10 more minutes. So, and we've got three, I'm going to dismiss this one because three more questions. I'm not sure we'll be able to get to them, but Clark, thanks for your patience. Do you have a question?
Yes. It's not really very philosophic, but let me just set it up by saying that I know that when David Kelly was excommunicated over 30 years ago, there was a lot of viciousness from ARI. And I believe the same thing may have happened with George Reisman. I mean, when you went to the website or even got their book catalog, suddenly the evidence of the census was somehow no longer there. So I guess what I'm getting at is, you know, is ARI still very hostile to the Atlas Society and maybe even the Objective Standard? And I guess I'm asking this from someone who's not a big name in objectivism by any means. I'm just a, you know, on the ground foot soldier. And quite frankly, I have a lot of, I don't know, Facebook friends who are, you know, they may not work for ARI, but they're pretty closely adjacent to it. And I sometimes wonder if they knew that I, you know, that I frequent clubhouses with the Atlas Society, they may turn pretty hostile to me. So I guess, could you speak to some of this? I mean, how do we go about our lives when, I mean, obviously I have people that I know that you know, that are, I consider them objectivists. Even Yaron Brook has done, you know, Leonard Peikoff, they've done great things. But then when I see how viciously they've treated people that they somehow don't any longer consider objectivists, I have a lot of trouble reconciling this.
I do too. there's a level of animosity here that I think goes beyond a difference of philosophical opinion and maybe personal elements involved too, but there's definitely animosity. I think it's somewhat declining. Since I've stepped back so far, maybe Jennifer and the chairman of our board, John, Jay LaPere and others on our board have talked with many of the people at ARI. So, and as I mentioned, they had that article in the that we responded to, the New Era in Objectivism, which they seemed to admit a number of things that we were saying, but. I'll leave it maybe to others who are closer to the ground than I am currently to answer your question. I would just say one thing, though, that, you know, in movements that have an authorized doctrine and any kind of authority, so like the Articles of Faith in Catholicism or the party line in communism, the doctrine can shift over time, but the natural history here is that there's no redemption for those who shifted too soon before it was politically correct. And I've seen that in objectivism too. It's an unfortunate psychological thing or movement thing, but it's not good. It's not good.
Brian, get you in the wire here.
Thanks. I know we're in a hurry. Hopefully my question is quickly answered. Of the five, I guess, branches, metaphysics, epistemology, ethics, politics, and aesthetics, which area do you think stands to gain the most by keeping, by using this open, approach?
I hadn't thought about that, but off the top of my head, I would say all of them. In every realm, there's room for further development. You know, the epistemology and metaphysics are more fundamental, and that means on the one hand they're more important. So if there are revisions to make, it's more important to do that and get that settled as best we can, but on the other hand, those are not nearly as complicated or talking about even, you know, the axiom of existence is not going to change. That metaphysical point, the ethics of families is, as I was saying earlier, a really open and really complicated issue. So,
and do you think that progress will come primarily from an organization like Atlas Society, you know, like a think tank, or will it come from academia, or maybe industry, or where do you see the most progress being made?
Well, right now, I think think tanks, because we don't have much representation in universities. Although people in universities like Richard and our other scholars, are carrying the ideas and developing them in their classes and scholarly writing. And I just want to say also, there are a lot of people in business who are applying objectivist ideas to the management of their business. And that's an area where I would expect, advances in understanding, and hopefully someone will be able to write them up.
Thank you.
Okay, Ed, you have a quick question? And, you know, I want to let everybody know tomorrow we have actually another clubhouse with Professor Salzman. It's going to be an Ask Me Anything on Objectivism. It's going to be 2:00 West Coast time. So we will have a chance to further develop some of these ideas that we've discussed today. So Ed, did you have a quick question that you want to bring up? Ed Hudgens? All right. He may have stepped.
Oops. There you go. No, I'm here. Okay. Yeah, just real quickly. Hi, David. In I think it was 1989 when Peikoff introduced his new course on objectivism in New York City, Ayn Rand answered questions. And I asked her, are there areas where she thinks objectivism needs more work? And she said the relationship between induction and deduction, which I point out is one of David Kelly's areas. And David, I don't know if you want to speak to that. I'll also mention, by the way, that in David's book and in the speech he gave in 1990 in February when he launched the organization, you mentioned, David, that Peikoff complained about people who have one foot in the objectivist world and the other foot in sort of the conventional world. And you rightly said, well, you should. I thought there was one world and we should have both feet in it. And I think that kind of answers the who cares whether it's consistent with Rand. It's got to be consistent with objective reality. I think that was the point you were making. I'm curious if you ever talked to Rand about induction versus deduction, which she identified as an area that needed more work.
Yeah, she did, and I think more work has been done. And at some point, even there was a lot of controversy about the induction book by Peikoff and Harriman in 2010. Mm-hmm. But at one point, Leonard said it in almost as many words that this is in addition to objectivism. So I don't know what to make of it, but I. Thanks for reminding me about the 2 feet in reality world, 2 feet in the world, or reality. That's what I come back to all the time. And I think we should all come back to that. We're thinkers. There's a world. Let's understand it.
Hear, hear.
Thank you. Thanks, David. Great questions. Great discussion, everyone. I learned a lot, as always, and we're going to be back tomorrow again on Clubhouse with Professor Richard Salzman. Please go to the Atlas Society website, sign up to get updates, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Thanks, everyone.